If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
So we're here with Gar Alperovitz, we're at the Public Banking Conference. Gar, I wanted to ask you, capitalism and democracy have often been equated with each other, especially in Canada and the United States. Is it past time to separate these two concepts, and are attitudes about this changing in America?
Well, capitalism, of course, has also been associated with fascism. That is to say, all of the great fascisms came out of capitalism. So I think the one-to-one equations are really time to get beyond that and beyond the categories of capitalism and socialism. I think we've been trapped by these kind of abstract rhetorical ideas. I sometimes ask people, if you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what do you want? And actually, when you begin to look at co-ops and public banking and worker-owned companies and public utilities, you begin to build a different model, small community, private ownership, individual ownership, complex vision that starts at community, problem solving, and it gets beyond these visions of one size or one word frames it for all.
Right. Now, you've said in the past that social systems are defined by who owns the capital. Could ours not be also defined by who prints or controls our money supply?
Both and, not either or. Because owning the capital, in the case of the banking industry, obviously, is controlled by very, very well-concentrated wealth, and in the banking industry as well, then that gives them the power to create money, and that gives you additional power and, as they say, high leverage on your existing money by the capacity to create money.
The U.S. money supply has never been larger than it is today. One can walk out the door and go into a grocery store containing acres of food, and yet at the same time on the same street there are people who are hungry, almost starving. Why is that? What's the difference between plenty and then the scarcity that seems to be around us at the same time?
Well, we don't have an economic problem at all. I say that to kind of startle you. The reason is that in the United States the economy currently produces $192,000 for every family of four. If it were running at decent levels, it would be $200,000 for every family of four. So there is no underlying weakness in the economy. The system is technologically powerful. There's a distributional problem, which is political, basically political, and the concentration of wealth and power is a question of whether we redress the issues politically that are creating these concentrations. It's also true that most of the wealth, and this is sometimes startling to people, there are many studies on this, derived from technological changes over many centuries, a large part of which were financed by the public. There would be no computer industry without the public investment, for instance. All the big money that's been made by Apple and all the big money that's been made by Bill Gates would not exist without public investment. So, yes, we need radical redistribution based on the fact that the public has been really behind a good deal of what's produced the wealth we now have.
You've been a key supporter of some of the most successful and ecologically sustainable worker-owned cooperative efforts in North America. What lessons do these projects have for citizens who want to set up, for example, a publicly owned bank?
Well, the question is, we have some good examples. We have the Bank of North Dakota. We've got a number of interesting nonprofit banks emerging in different parts of the country. So piece by piece, I think what the answer is to start where you can, to look at these examples, and in the specific community that you live in, and the specific province or state, whether or not there's an adaptation that is appropriate to the context. And then to see it historically. If the first round doesn't produce quite what you want, maybe the second round can advance it and revise it in advance. So I think there is a lot of experience on the ground that can be built on if you take a historical and developmental perspective.
Now, if you could talk a little bit about the Evergreen Co-op model in Cleveland, Ohio, that's brought together workers and small business in an alliance that defies these traditional right-left stereotypes. Why is that?
Well, a city like Cleveland, which has gone from 900,000 to less than 400,000 over the last three decades, is in very great trouble. So the small business community is in trouble, as well as the low-income black community. The recreation of this model, which is a series of worker-owned companies, large-scale worker-owned companies, linked together by a revolving fund and a nonprofit corporation. They just aren't the kind that can go make a few people rich. That model builds the community, builds the tax base, produces new consumers, that small businessmen are helped with it. It helps with the tax problem that small business people face, because if the tax base isn't there, they're going to have to carry more of the load. So there is a very interesting non-ideological, practical aspect to this, even though it involves changing who owns wealth. We found at the local level, quite apart from all the ideologues and kind of rhetorical bombast at the national level, people are interested in practical answers. And people who are very conservative often are interested in the practical answer that may involve changing who owns the wealth. If it makes, giving, they put it this way, give people a piece of the action, a piece of the wealth. And it makes sense to both left, right, and center in our experience.
And in your research, you found that over 130 million Americans are members of such nascent cooperative organizations already.
Right. That's the number of America, 130 million, are members of one or another form of co-op. Now, a large part of those are credit union co-ops, all of which are one person, one vote. And in a way, this is very interesting because it's open to democratic control, and people haven't acted on their existing capacities. They could really make use of that power greater because it is a one-person, one-vote ownership of wealth.
Whenever the idea of public banking is brought forward, business school professors, academics, often respond automatically that such schemes just won't work, and yet they do work in many places and have for many decades. Despite the fact economists get to frame the debate in the abstract, based on your experience, what advice do you have for people who are trying to promote the idea of public banking on how to get their message out and frame the debate in a way to win the debate?
Well, there's lots of different ways to do it. Alan Brown has been a terrific researcher and writer about this, but the Bank of North Dakota is a great example. And it's been much better in terms of small business, it's been better in terms of farms, better in terms of housing, student loans, and there it sits, an American experience, very practical, good experience. Internationally, about 40% of the banking assets of the world are in public banks. And in some of the most powerful, the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, you find public banks are really fueling a very powerful economic resurgence, 40% of the world. And Americans are ignorant of this, and they're ignorant of it in large part because some people don't want you to know about these things. If the educational system would open up the door, I'm an economist, and my profession is really narrow-minded about these questions and doesn't like to study international experience, and I think pays no attention to the Bank of North Dakota. So you really do have to get beyond the confines of what passes for economics in this country and look around the world, or just go to North Dakota.
Final question. What makes you pessimistic and what makes you optimistic about the situation faced by progressives in America and Canada today?
Well, it's a difficult time, but my own view as a historian is if you actually look at what difficult times can do if people act appropriately, is that it raises awareness amongst lots of people that something's really wrong. And if you have practical things to offer and a larger vision of step-by-step how you're going forward, in these times, I think you look historically, people have often laid the groundwork for something new. I sometimes think of this period, the next decades, as the foundational period, laying the foundations upon which a transformative period might build. Like in the American situation, the prehistory of the New Deal was almost all grassroots, local, and state development. And when the moment came, the ideas were applied at a larger scale at the national level. Now, one can't predict the future, but that model, I think, gives you kind of a hope for what we ought to be thinking about trying to do step by step as we go forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alperovitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.